Hello and welcome everyone to Leaders in Elder Care, the interview series designed to share with you some of the many people who are doing great things to change the face of elder care as we know it. I'm Ryan Malone, founder of Inside Elder Care and your host of Leaders in Elder Care today. Before we start, I'd like to remind you to subscribe to the podcast. You can do so in a couple different ways. The first is to go to leadersineldercare.com. In the top right-hand corner, there's a subscribe button. Or if you're on iTunes, you can search the podcasts for Leaders in Elder Care and click on the subscribe button there. Let's get started. Joining us today is Dr. Richard Taylor. Dr. Taylor is the author of Alzheimer's from the Inside Out, a unique book of essays chronicling a rare glimpse inside the little understood world of Alzheimer's from the perspective of the person who has it. Through his website and other vehicles, Dr. Taylor chronicles his life with dementia and the world to see it in such a transparent way that I think is very unique and that the readers will enjoy. How are you doing today, Richard?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Fantastic. I'm actually really, really excited about the interview. I've been following your website for probably about 5 months or so now. I've met a couple good friends of yours along the way on my elder care journey, and your name always seems to pop up when I ask the question, you know, who is somebody that I should meet? So it's truly an honor for me to get to speak with you today, and I'm excited about it. Can you share with the listeners your story?
Well, I may be one of the most unforgettable characters you meet, but I'm a little surprised that I'm on an elder care leader list here. Leaders really require followers, and I have no followers. And I'm not in a position, nor do I intend to lead a movement. I am myself. I just talk about myself. What's it like to have Alzheimer's disease? The fact that I'm a psychologist means that I think about thinking a lot, and even though I can't be a practicing psychologist now, I still think about thinking, so I think about my own thinking all the time. So from that perspective, I have a little different slant on what it's like to have Alzheimer's disease, but it's just me. I don't purport to be the voice of Alzheimer's or even a voice of Alzheimer's. I'm just Richard. I'm 67 years old. I live in a little town just north of Houston, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
One day my daughter was visiting me, and as she was leaving, she turned to my wife and said, "There's something wrong with Dad." She hadn't seen me in a year. And as we were driving home from dropping her off at the airport, my wife said to me, "You know, your daughter thinks there's something wrong with you." And I said, "Well, that's not news." She says, "Well, this is something new wrong with you." I said, "Well, what is it?" She said, "I don't know. She wouldn't tell me." So I called her, and what she essentially did was go down the early warning signs of Alzheimer's disease, although that was unknown to me. I had gone with her once, taken her to go to the doctor with me, and we stopped, talked to some friends, and I forgot to go to the doctor. And we came home, and she said to my wife, "He didn't go to the doctor." And she said, "Well, he does that all the time. I just call and make a new appointment."
Mm-hmm.
So even then, people are covering up for you.
Mm-hmm.
I would get bewildered sometimes, just kind of, I called it flabbergasted, where I just didn't know what was happening. But then I would kind of snap back into it. I was searching for words, and I've never searched for words in my life. And I got lost a couple of times, lost in a way that I really didn't know. It's not that I didn't know how to get to where I was going. I didn't know where I was.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to my doctor, and make a long story short, a year later I was diagnosed. It was a tremendous emotional impact on me and my family. We all cried for about 3 weeks straight till we didn't have any tears left to cry.
Uh-huh.
And then we sat down as a family, and I said, well, what are we going to do about this? How will we respond to this as a family? And I don't remember who said it first, but somebody said, well, there's nothing to respond to. You're still dad. You're still my husband. You're still our friend. We'll cross those bridges when we come to them. And we actually had no idea what the bridges were we were talking about. None of us knew anything about Alzheimer's. Why we cried so hard is the, it's the topic for some psychologist's book other than myself. What are the fears that when you say Alzheimer's disease that causes friends not to call you anymore?
Mm.
What are the fears about having dementia that caused it initially to be called insanity? People have lost their mind. And from a cultural perspective, our culture now sees people as having dementia as being defective. You know, they even call it the long goodbye. When actually we're here every single day. We're all here. We may not be all here the way we were yesterday, but we're all here today.
Right.
And people tend to look at you in terms of what you've lost as opposed to what you have. And it's the wrong question to ask, are people with dementia half full or half empty? They're always full. Everybody is always full. It's just that some of our cognitive functions are slipping. And I've stopped using the word decaying, or we're losing them, because they come back once in a while, or they come back in a twisted sort of form. It's not like we're going somewhere, like we're going insane, or we're going into a stupor, or we're going off into la-la land, or a place where we just sit motionless and never have a thought.
Mm-hmm.
Even people who are deep into the symptoms of dementia, sitting in a wheelchair, haven't spoken for years, they have brain waves. And if you walk up to that person and call out their name, that EEG jigamahuja will jump up and down. They recognize their name. And if you pat them on the back, that little thing goes up and down, signifying brain activity.
Mm-hmm.
But we just don't know how to interpret that, because we can't use words and they can't use words to describe that. But just because we can't describe it doesn't mean it isn't there. It doesn't mean that we're still not a whole human being. And that's become one of the crusades of my life. After I was diagnosed, I went into teaching. And I taught for about 3 years, 4 years, I think it was, until I couldn't deal with the administrivia teaching anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then I stayed home. And I caught myself going the wrong way once on a highway, and so I stopped driving. So I stayed home even more. And I began to sleep more and watch more TV. And at the time, I didn't realize it. I became depressed. I got on antidepressants. I went into therapy for a year. All that happened because I lost a sense of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have access to the tools that I needed to create a new sense of purpose, the ability to go somewhere whenever I wanted to, spend money, interact with other people. And I think that happens to most people who have dementia. If you look into the eyes of folks who have been placed in, they call them communities. They used to call them gated communities. Before that, they were locked wards. You don't see a spark in their eyes anymore. What's the reason they wake up in the morning? To play bingo? You know, to sing old hymns? Well, over time, that's what is the center of people's lives. And I guess I'm so afraid that I'm going to be reduced to that. I've tried to become a champion of people trying to understand and relate to people as whole people rather than as sick people or ill people. So, back to myself. I stayed home a lot, and I started to write. I had a fear that someday I was going to wake up and there was going to be some transformation had happened. A curtain had dropped between myself and the world. And I'd look out through the curtain and I wouldn't know who was there. I wouldn't recognize anybody. And they wouldn't recognize me. And I'd turn and look in a mirror and I wouldn't know myself. And I was really scared that was going to happen. So I started to write for about an hour every night. Just what went on during the day, what thoughts went through my head, what were my fears, funny stories, cute stories. And then the next morning I'd read it. And if it made sense to me, it was proof to me that I was still okay. Now, that sounds like a very simplistic measure, but when you're scared, you do some weird things, you know, which in hindsight you say, well, that was so simple, or why did you do that? So I wrote every day for about 180 days. And one of those 180 days, I stopped and showed it to someone who was in my group who had Alzheimer's. And he read it. And he said, oh, my God, I thought I was the only one that felt this way. I don't remember what it was about, but. And so we started to talk about my writings in the group, because not everyone is as introspective as I am, thank heavens, and not everyone is as verbal as I am, thank heavens. But everyone has the same kinds of internal conversations with themselves that I have,
right,
who has dementia and Alzheimer's. And then one day, one of the people with Alzheimer's in my group showed it to his caregiver. And she said, oh, my God, if I had known you felt this way, I would have treated you differently. And he said, well, I tried to tell you. She said, yeah, but it's a lot clearer here. So I sent one of them away to a guy whose book I had read for him to look at. And he wrote me back and said, have you got any more of these? I said, oh, I got a ton of them, you know. So I sent them all to him. He sent them all to somebody else, who in turn sent them to their publisher. And one day somebody called me from Health Professions Press and said, we'd like to publish your book. And I said, what book? And they said, well, you know, the book that you wrote. I said, I didn't write any book. They said, oh, yeah, you wrote this book, Alzheimer's from the Inside Out. So that's how I wrote the book, anyway. I really didn't set out to write it. I didn't intend to write it. And it's not a book in that it's my story. It's a bunch of stories about someone who has Alzheimer's and was a former psychologist. And literally, the day after the book came out, book came out on December 30th, 2006, I think it was. People started to call me and ask me if I'd come and speak. They thought I'd gotten smarter because I published a book. And actually, I hadn't. So anyway, I went and started to do some speaking, and I was so pleased that anybody would ask to listen to me. I paid my own way and paid for my own hotel and gave a little speech and then came home. Well, I got more and more of these. And one day somebody offered me $500 for doing it. I thought, whoa, that's nice. So then I started to ask people for $500. And then one day I have a friend who's a physician, and he told me what he gets paid for going somewhere and speaking for an hour. So then I started to charge $1,000. And pretty soon, this became my way of making a living.
Mm-hmm.
I actually make a living doing this now. And I charge people to do this. And I expect to be reimbursed for my expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And I just go, and I always begin by saying, hello, my name is Richard, and I have Alzheimer's disease.
What is the crowd like in terms of the makeup of the crowd? Is it predominantly people who've been diagnosed or family members? Or
it depends on who's sponsoring me and how it was promoted. Sometimes it's family members. Sometimes it's people with Alzheimer's. Sometimes it's professionals who are there to get their CEUs. Sometimes they're mixed audiences.
Mm-hmm.
But all of them are very intrigued by seeing somebody stand up and say, I have Alzheimer's disease, and then not forgetting or wandering off at the moment.
What have you found, you know, as you you started this incredible journey, what have you found most rewarding about it?
Well, it's therapeutic for me to talk out my own issues, actually, in public. And it is just a tremendous experience for me to sit at a table afterwards and people come up to me and tell me, you know, what a difference the book has made. We've read this book and it helped us communicate better with each other, or I saw that there's a life after Alzheimer's disease. And it's had some impact on some professionals who thought they knew Alzheimer's disease, thought they knew everything. And I think over time, we just kind of slip into this paternalistic model and perception of how a person with dementia is, because they become more and more dependent on you to provide some of the skills that they have lost. And after a while, we don't see them as a whole person. We see them as every day they're a little more diminished as a person. And it's just amazing to people, for someone who is actually diagnosed with the disease, to not be that far into the disease, that they can still stand up and remember a question that somebody asks.
Right. What have you found the most challenging?
Right now the most challenging thing for me is just keeping up with all this. I'm just befuddled by all the details of life now. I mean, my job is more than I can handle cognitively, and I have an assistant, and I have a very loyal and dear and competent wife as a caregiver, and I couldn't do what I do now without them. It was an emotional issue for me to see people who were more advanced than I was with their symptoms. I got over this idea that there was going to be this curtain dropping, because I talked to enough people who were further into the disease, but they still stepped out to the front of the stage from time to time. So then my new set of fears was, well, what's going to happen to me when I can't take care of myself anymore, you know, when I end up in Happy Hollows or wherever I will be? How will people relate to me there? And
right.
So I started, when I went out to speak, I started to stay in these units, these memory units, and these assisted living communities. And I ate with people who were deep into the symptoms of dementia sometimes. And I found it to be very unsettling to me. The staff would come in, and they were cheery-deery and lovable and well-intended human beings, really loved what they did. And they'd come in and start everybody eating, and then they would leave, and everybody would just sit there silently eating, not saying anything, not talking to each other. Eating wasn't an activity. It was barely an event. It was just something that they came and got me at 5 o'clock to do. And so I started talking to people. Now, it took me 5 minutes to get about half the room talking. It's not that I got everybody to talk or everybody wanted to talk or even could talk. But people who hadn't talked in a long time started to talk because I took the time to sit and listen to them. And I don't know if they were telling me the truth or not. They were telling me their version of it. And I found them to be very interesting and bright people.
They're the same people they were before they got sick.
Of course they are. Of course they are. I mean, they still are the same essence of the person. And, you know, so I began to say to people, has anybody ever lied to you since you got dementia? I haven't met one person yet who has dementia that said no. What is it? What's the reason that people give for doing things to you that you don't want done to you? What's the most frequently used reason, justification? And they all say safety. We're doing this for your own good, Mom. We're stripping your house of all the rugs and pushing all the furniture up against the wall and taking out all the tables and have a good life. And then the children fly off to back to California and the mother lives in her apartment. I was actually in a lady's apartment where that happened. She brought me up to show me what her son had done. So that has become my new fears of I don't want to be treated that way. I don't want to spend one day less mute in a wheelchair than I have to. And I think people with I saw this in myself. People who are diagnosed with dementia start withdrawing the day after they get diagnosed. You know, they run and hide in a closet. They don't want to tell other people they have it. They make more of an effort conscientiously to cover up whatever their cognitive deficits are rather than look for ways to reach out to other people to help them deal with just what is a natural occurrence. You know, if I'd have lost my arm in a logging accident, the next day everybody in my family would have been on the phone, on the web, looking for a prosthetic arm. And they'd get me the best one they could find, but they would always know it was a prosthetic arm. And they would always help me in ways that the arm couldn't help me anymore if I needed to lift something heavy or this way or that way. But the day after I was diagnosed with dementia, everybody cried. And that's about how people deal with the disability of dementia. Everybody cries about it. It's sort of like cancer. Used to be.
So what do you tell somebody? I mean, you've seen, you know, obviously yourself, and you've experienced, you know, countless other people. There's obviously going to be people listening to this who are either just got diagnosed with dementia or you know, some form of it, and there's probably family members who just had a loved one. What do you tell them? Like, what do you say personally to them? Because they're going to go through the same things that you did and that your family did.
Yeah, I tell them, you know, this is not the beginning of the end. You are fortunate in that you have now some understanding of how you might die. There's a higher probability if you live long enough, this is how you're going to die. So do you have to make any plans for that now? Now, that doesn't mean you couldn't be hit by a car tomorrow or come down with cancer or a piano drops on your head. You could still die anyway. And this is not the beginning of the long goodbye for you. This is the beginning of a new way of you're going to have to deal with life. And I used to say, you know, wait till you cross those bridges. I used to say, we'll get through it all together. But I think that's what's needed is for the whole family to sit down and say, look, someone has dementia in our family now. No one's ever had dementia in our family before. This is going to make a difference in how that person needs us and how that person lives their lives and how we get along as a family. You know, we never used to talk about these issues before because we worked out rules about how we got along with each other. And they've worked for 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 or 70 years. But those rules aren't going to work anymore because Dr. Alzheimer's is at the table, or Dr. Lewy bodies, or Dr. Pick, or Dr. Ischemic dementia, or whatever form of dementia you have. So we need to open ourselves up in different ways to each other, because that's the only way we're going to get through this in a healthy form.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we're just doomed to be more dysfunctional than we are at this moment. So I try to get people to just be open to each other. You don't need another website. You don't need another group. You don't need another pill right this second. You may have a need for all those. What you need right now is each other. And you need to open up to each other in a way that enables everybody to support you, and vice versa. They need to open up in a way that you can allow yourself to be supported, because they're going to be, to some extent, your cognitive functions in some situations at some
mm-hmm.
times, because you're losing those. But they're never going to be you. You're still going to be yourself. And you should always be responsible for yourself. You should always do as much for yourself as you can. We'll expect you to still be yourself as a whole person, as a functioning member of this family who may have a disability, but you're still a full member of this family. And we just need to work our way through the issues that come up and try to anticipate some of them and see how we can, you know, prophylactically deal with them before they come up.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't wait until I have an accident to talk about my driving. We shouldn't wait until I bounce checks to talk about how we're going to handle the money.
Right.
We need to phase our way into that. We got time. But time is what we need to use. Now, some people don't have as much time as others because we're very late in acknowledging the symptoms of the disease, if indeed it's a disease, the symptoms at least.
Right.
We ignore them. We don't deal with them until they become safety issues. We say you're growing old, or that's the way mommy is, or it's an Alzheimer's moment, you know. But we don't reach out to each other and say, that just smells of a little disability, you know. If I knew you were colorblind, if I discovered that, I'd help you when it came time to looking at the red light. But if I know you're forgetful, I don't help you remember things. I just say you're forgetful, and I leave you and Dad to live with each other until I have to institutionalize you. And I worry about the day you might have to move in with us. So that's the advice I give people. I try to, I don't like to give advice in the sense that when people ask me direct questions, what should I say when this happens or that? I usually say to people, I don't have the words for you to say. What I'm trying to do is model and be an example of what it's like to live with this disease. And if you let in my perspective, if you stand in my shoes for a moment or two, I'm confident that if you already loved me, you'll just love me in more appropriate ways now. And the words will come to you. They just will. It's just that you don't understand me right now. And if you understood me in a different light, I'm confident for most people, you'd get along better. The words would be better. So I always try to go to the bigger picture rather than get down to, well, what should I say when he says this or when he says that?
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that's about the only time when people call the helpline. That's what people want, is an answer to a specific problem they're having that's reaching crisis proportion. And they get overwhelmed by it. And so their response is, well, I'll lie about it. Their response is, I'll do something that under normal circumstances I wouldn't do, but these aren't normal circumstances. We need to start changing the circumstances before you get right up against the wall.
What can the people that are listening do to help you with the mission that you've set out to accomplish in terms of letting everybody know this message?
They can encourage people they know who have dementia to stand up and speak out about it. Everyone with dementia once a year should talk to their Sunday school class about what it's like for them to live with dementia. Everyone with dementia who belonged to some kind of club or organization should go back there and talk to them about how they're coping with dementia. Because it's so spooky, it's such a dark subject. It's so scary to people to think about losing control of yourself. We need to go back and say, I haven't lost control. I still lose my place. I still lose my thought, but I haven't lost control. I'm still me. So that's one thing they can do, is encourage others to speak up and speak out. I think everyone can, we're in a crazy situation now where we're hell-bent on throwing as much money as we can get at trying to find a cure for Alzheimer's disease. We just don't know. We don't know what causes it. I can't understand how you can cure something when you don't know what the cause of it is.
Mm-hmm.
You're just lying to yourself that you've cured it. You may have stopped it, but you don't know for a fact that you caused it because you don't know what causes it, or that you've cured it. You don't know what causes it. And the brain is so more complicated than we thought it was. You know, we could get a polio vaccine because we understood viral infections. But we don't understand the brain. And once we learned that polio was a virus, we didn't have any trouble finding the vaccine for it.
Right.
It was just discovering it was a virus. Well, when we discovered it was a virus, we knew a lot about viruses. Well, we don't have an ecology of the brain. We don't quite understand, not quite. We don't understand how it works. And we're getting all these slices of the brain, but no two slices butt up against each other. So we get a little bit of knowledge, and the headlines say a new breakthrough in Alzheimer's research, and everybody gets all hepped up, and the drug company picks it up, and does some studies on it. And by the time the pill tumbles down the pipeline, it's not much of an impact on people. And in fact, some of them have just fallen flat on the ground.
Right.
So people can help turn this tide. See, when you have a finite number of dollars to spend on a disease for research, I don't believe you should spend 98% of it on bench research. We don't understand the psychosocial aspects of Alzheimer's disease. We don't understand when someone isn't talking, what's going on inside their head? What are they thinking about? What kinds of ways can we be trained in to communicate with people in that situation? How can we hang on to communicating with them as they drift into that situation? Rather than once somebody forgets your name, that's it. So we need far more psychosocial research. And we're fixing to throw lots of money at a cure for Alzheimer's. And the justification that they give for it is, well, we're going to save money with Medicare. We're going to free up more beds. Well, what about the people who have Alzheimer's? What about, there's about 5 million people who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and there's close to 5 million people who have other forms of dementia. We're spending almost no money to in research to improve the quality of their lives. The best we can do is with some pills say, well, this will slow down the progression of your disease in between 30 and 60% of the people who take it.
Mm-hmm.
However, 30% of the people who take the yellow M&M are going to have the same results as you do. So since we don't know what the cause is, we can't in a medical sort of way, in a physical sort of way, measure the impact of the pill on whatever the process is that causes this. We can just say, do you feel better?
Right.
Can you now tie your shoes? Do you put your pants on right now? We ask the caregiver, does he seem happier? Well, this whole cognitive disease idea is different from other kinds of diseases in that we can cover up our symptoms by ourselves. And I think that's what's happened, I think the disease probably progresses inexorably, whatever the process of it is. But different people at different times, given different motivations, in different situations, are better able to deal with the symptoms. They're able to cover up the symptoms. And it's not that the disease is being slowed, its progress. It's that I've learned to cope with the symptoms in a more positive sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
And the world then says, oh yeah, we're slowing down the progress of the disease. Well, the question you ask the world then is, well, what is the progress of the disease? Does it move 20 miles an hour? Does it move 5 feet a minute? Does it move 10 miles and then stop for a week and then move another 10 miles?
Right.
It moves differently in every person. So there is no progress of the disease in the sense that it's something that's measurable. So everyone could say to the National Alzheimer's Association, to people who are raising money in the name of Alzheimer's for bench research, wait a minute, why don't you spend 30% of your money on psychosocial research? Why don't you stop looking for a cure and looking for a way to help people live as full of lives as they can, given the fact that they have declining cognitive abilities? Don't you have just as much a moral obligation to do that as you do to take money to try to cure the disease? I think you do. I think you even have more of a moral obligation. You start spending your money to cure the disease after you've helped people who have the disease as much as you can. And we've got that back-asswards, way back-asswards, where we spend little money to help people with the disease and lots of money to help people who don't have the disease not get the disease because we have a vaccine, because we have a pill you can take. it's an absurd way that we are responding to dementia, it seems to me. It makes
so
me
if,
mad.
So if people wanna follow you, I know you said you don't have any followers, but I know that a lot of people follow your website. If for the people that are listening, if they want to learn more about you and sign up for your newsletter and follow your journey, how do they do that?
Oh, yeah. Go to my website. It's richardtaylorphd.com. I don't mean to discourage you from buying my book. And I'm going to have a couple of DVDs out because people come up to me and they say, well, I want to buy your book and give it to my son, but I don't think he'll read it. Do you have a DVD? He might watch it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm making a couple of DVDs. They're going to come out soon. Just follow my website because that's where I post a lot of my writings there. And I put out a monthly newsletter that goes out to about 12,000 people now.
Those are those people you said don't follow you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but they follow me at a distance with their finger on the delete button. No, I don't see myself as a leader. I see myself as an influencer or maybe a difference maker. I don't know.
Well, I see you as a leader, and I don't think
that
leaders necessarily need to be the head of the organization, and a lot of times it's the people that go about their business who end up being the biggest heroes. So I want to personally thank you for the time that you spent with us today. I want to thank you for being a leader in elder care and really sharing something that is so deep and personal with the people that are listening.
Well, I want to thank you for doing this, not only with me, but for all the other people you've done it with and will do it with. It's very hard for us to be recognized, you know. And when we are, and when we're promoted, that is, our thinking or our experience is promoted, people see us as the exception to the rule, when actually we are the rule. It's the other people who are the exceptions. But those are the ones that get reported on the most, the people are having the most trouble with this. So it's people like you, really, that are leading to show people that there are leaders, there are people who have cognitive disabilities, yet they still speak up and speak out, and you're helping to make that possible for people.
Well, I appreciate it very much. For all of our listeners out there, just a reminder, be sure to check out two websites, Inside Elder Care, which is a by families, for families approach to helping families deal with elder care issues. It's available at www.insideeldercare.com, and Portrait of Our Parents, which is a storytelling website designed to let you share the brilliant memories you have of a parent, a loved one, a grandparent, or any other elder friend. It's available at portraitofourparents.com. And please do go out and visit Richard's website at richardtaylorphd.com. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Have a great day, and I hope you come back and listen again soon.
Thank you.